Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Do you remember the magic faraway tree? What about the famous five or the secret seven? Were they part of your childhood? Well, what about your own children? Did they read these books? For me, when I was a kid, every night my dad would read from the famous five until I fell asleep. It was, in fact, the very first book series that I fell in love with. And I think it was all the characters, as well as the adventure, the actual story. But the characters of Julian, Dick, Anne, and George were really, really just fascinating for me. Mostly, I think it was Timmy the dog. Enid Blyton, of course, was the author of all of these classics. And still to this day, she holds the record for the world's largest selling author of children's books of all time. She's even pipped J.K. Rowling. Astonishing, given she died in 1968. So tonight, a deep dive into the world of Enid Blyton, often dubbed the children's favourite storyteller. With me is Andrew Maunder. He is a lecturer in English literature in the UK and is the author of Enid Blyton, A Literary Life. Hello and welcome to Weekend Nightlife, Andrew.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be here.
The children's favourite storyteller. It's quite a title that Enid Blyton had to live up to.
Yes, although it's probably a title she would have given herself as well. She's a very good publicist of her own work. and she saw herself as that person anyway, yes.
She was so prolific. I think she published over 700 titles. So prolific that I think I read at one point she was writing a book a week.
Yeah, that was her claim, that she could write a book of the length of The Secret Seven, for example, in a week, that she would start on Monday and finish on Sunday, and she would just type and type and type on her typewriter until she couldn't physically type anymore. But yeah, she claimed that the idea just came to her and she couldn't stop when she started.
Yeah, I mean, she sold something like 600 million books worldwide. That is an incredible number.
Yes, and partly because she wrote so much, therefore there's a lot of text to sell, and partly because she's continued to be popular through the generations as well. So people who read her in the 1930s and 40s, then they passed her on to their children and so on and so on. So she's continued to be possible and passed down through generations, I think.
And is that still happening, Andrew?
I think it is. I mean, she's still sold by Hachette in the UK. They own the rights to her work and they still market her as well. So she's still very, very popular. And if you go into bookshops in the UK especially, there are whole shelves devoted still to Enid Blyton. So someone is buying her,
yeah.
I guess.
So her books are still in print?
Some of them are still in print. Some of them have gone out of print. But The kind of the famous series, like the Famous Five, Secret Seven, the mystery series, Mallory Towers and so on, they're still in print, yes.
Yeah. So why? Why was she so popular? I think she was earning at her peak the equivalent of $2 million a year, which is an incredible salary for a writer.
Yes. Possibly more than that at some parts, I think. I guess if you think of something like the Famous Five, I guess you were talking about it in reduction, and they're kind of popular, I think, because they offer children a kind of fantasy escape into adventure, and they're allowed to go off on their own and with no adults present, hardly any adults in the works, and they go off camping and staying in lighthouses and caravans and so on. So offer a kind of escapism to children, which has been very appealing, I think, and children who, I guess, live very kind of rule-bound, restricted lives, like this kind of escapism that the Blyton offers.
Yeah, and not just popular in England, but popular right across the world. I think her books have been translated into 90 languages.
Oh, at least, I think, yes. And yeah, in the kind of 1950s, especially popular in places like kind of South Africa and Australia, New Zealand, and so on, because Blyton, it was claimed, seemed to offer a kind of version of England, which was based on green fields and the countryside and having picnics and so on. It seemed to kind of strike a chord with people, I think.
Yeah. Well, definitely it was an idyllic childhood that that many of the kids in her books were experiencing. So in recent years, she has come under quite a bit of criticism, her works. Why do you think that is, and do you think it's fair?
she has come under criticism as well. I think the criticism is, I'm going to stay on the fence and say fair and not fair. So she's come under criticism because of the perceived racism in her work. I'm going to say perceived, but there is racism in her work, and we can't really deny that. And so Brighton, I think, was a racist by any standard in a way. People sometimes say, well, most people thought like that at the time, but actually that doesn't take away from the fact that they still had kind of racist views. And some of those views come across in the works that she wrote. For example, in Noddy, for example, you have the Gollywogs in Noddy. You have pets in certain books where you have a black dog and the dog is given the N-word as its name. So there are kind of traces of a kind of latent racism in the stories, which I guess nowadays we've kind of recognised that for what it is in a way. But when she was writing it, it just seemed to be part and parcel of how she wrote in a way.
And so do you feel, as a lecturer in English literature, that the books, if they are continuing to be sold and printed, do you think they should be edited or revised to make them more relevant to a today's context?
That is a good question as well. Actually, I think not, in a way, because my line on this is that these books are part of the historical record. This is how people in the 1930s, 40s, that's how they wrote. And we shouldn't, I guess, water that down and pretend that it didn't exist. I mean, I argue that there are certain books where you could just take them out of print in a way and not publish them. You don't have to publish everything that Blyton ever wrote. Some of it's not very good. So why would you publish it? But other books, which obviously can be quite snobbish as well in places, I think they should be kind of taken as part of the kind of historical record, in the same way that we continue to publish someone like Joseph Conrad, for example, and Heart of Darkness, which again is seen as a very problematic text in terms of its depiction of race and Africa and so on. It's just part and parcel of what these historical texts were at the time.
Indeed. We are talking about the life and times of Enid Blyton, who was dubbed the children's favourite storyteller. Andrew, you say she gave or would have given herself that name herself?
Yes. She was a very good self-publicist and managed to, partly through the fact that she ran magazines as well. So starting with a magazine called Sunny Stories in 1926, which then became another magazine called Enid Blyton's Magazine in 1953. She wrote in these magazines, which were published monthly or weekly in some cases, and she tended to use the magazines as vehicles for her own work. So you basically had lots of Enid Blyton stories coming out every week, and they'll be there in the newsagents all the time. So the market becomes kind of saturated by them as well. And she also tended to include a letter from herself to her readers. So she established this kind of personality where she was like this kind of auntie speaking to her readers on a weekly basis, and they felt they knew her. So the sense that she established this very close relationship with readers, which became quite a powerful bond between them as well. And that extended all over the world as well. So when Enid Blyton's magazine was published in the 50s, she wrote to her readers in India and Australia and so on, often referenced them as well. So establishing a kind of global village through her magazine, really.
Gosh, a woman ahead of her time. Let's go back to her.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah, let's go back to her early beginnings as a writer. She, in her children's books, really paints this sort of idyllic, picture-perfect family life of great adventure and great excitement. But her own upbringing was not a very happy one, was it?
No. So much has been made of her early upbringing in Beckenham, Kent. So her parents split up when she was 12, I think, and her father, to whom she was devoted, left the family home and set up life with a new family. And so Enid was left there with her two brothers and a mother who she didn't really get on with, and a mother who had apparently very kind of firm views about what a girl's role should be, i.e. domesticity and keeping house, and had very little truck with Enid's own ambitions to write. So she tried to escape that as soon as she was able at 18 and trained as a teacher, where she thought she would get more scope for fulfilling her ambitions in a way.
And so she leaves home at a very young age, 19 or something, and she never saw her parents again. She never saw her mother again.
I think she had occasional meetings with her mother, but yeah, very sporadic meetings. They didn't really keep in touch. She didn't go to her mother's funeral when the mother died about 1950. And she even lost contact with her brothers as well. So yes, in a way, she did deliberately make this kind of cut off from her actual family, mm-hmm. in a way, yeah.
So she finds writing and she writes about, you know, wonderful kind of childhood adventures with very happy endings. But her own life when she marries and meets her first husband, Hugh Pollock, that wasn't a particularly happy family either. She had two daughters with him and she wasn't a particularly wonderful mother by all accounts.
It's strange, yes. So she met a man called Hugh Pollock, who was an editor for the publisher Nunes, which is convenient in a sense. So he helped her kind of establish her career a bit more. And she became very successful. And then they had two daughters, Gillian and then Imogen. But actually, the daughters have very different stories about what their childhood was like. So the elder daughter, Gillian, has a much more positive outlook on what childhood was like, partly because her mother was less successful then and less busy, while the younger daughter, Imogen, did have a very different take on what it was like, felt kind of neglected and isolated, and felt that her mother was sometimes a stranger to her. So there were nannies and cooks and servants and so on. So by the time that Imogen was growing up, it was quite a rigid kind of ordered world that Blyton had established for herself so that nothing would interfere with her work, really, I think.
I think I read something that Imogen, the youngest daughter, said when she was born, she said, take this baby away. I don't want to breastfeed this baby. I don't want anything to do with her care either. And she only gave like a 30-minute or 1 hour a day to even see the child, the newborn child. That's extraordinary from a mother.
Yes. I don't know whether it was typical at the time if you're living in a certain class. I don't know. I'm sure it was true of the royal family as well, in a way. But the sense that you have a world of servants and of staff who kind of make life easier for you so that you can pursue your own career. I mean, there are letters as well that Blyton writes where she speaks very affectionately of her children and taking them to dancing lessons and shopping and so on. So perhaps the overall picture is slightly more kind of complicated than we are led to believe in some senses as well.
Mm. It does seem to me, though, that Enid Blyton was living almost two realities, one in her mind about the sort of life she wanted to have, and she spoke about that through her books. But then there was another reality, the real one, the one that she sort of had at home with two children that she didn't really care for very well and a husband that she didn't really pay much attention to. She seemed to fill her house with, you know, have parties with lots of friends, but her husband wasn't really in the picture.
No, so that the marriage to Hugh Pollock broke down during the Second World War, and Blyton married again. And in both sense, yeah, the sense of her career does come first in a way. Partly, I think, because it becomes a kind of treadmill as well, in a sense. She has this body of readers all over the world who are waiting on her to produce the next book, the next story. So something in her makes her feel obliged that she has to do this to kind of keep her readers happy. They are her family in one sense. They're the ones that she's trying to keep satisfied almost. So it becomes a kind of treadmill almost, her career. But also, as you say, a way of escaping, I think, as well. She lives through her characters and what they're doing as well.
Mm, as her marriage was breaking down to Hugh Pollock, in comes Dorothy Richards, who became her rock. Was Dorothy Richards a former nurse of hers and then became a lover?
I'm not sure about that. So Dorothy Richards was brought in when Imogen was born to kind of be the nursemaid for Imogen, but also struck up a warm friendship with Enid as well. There's not really any evidence that they were lovers, I don't think. They were kind of close friends and did rely on each other. And Blyton relied on Dorothy for advice in some sense. But I'm not sure there's really any sense they were lovers, mm-hmm. as we would understand it.
I think I read somewhere that she filled her house with parties for friends, tennis parties and bridge parties, and she even played tennis in the nude with her friends.
Again, I think that's one of those rumors that kind of circulates, isn't it? Like, it sounds interesting, but I'm not sure there's any evidence. I'm sure her neighbors in polite Beaconsfield would have talked about it more if that had been happening, I think. Yes.
So
a local celebrity. Yes.
So then she writes out her first husband from her life and says to the children, "You're never to see him again." And she takes up with her second husband, Kenneth Darrell Waters. What was that relationship like?
He was a surgeon, a doctor, who she met during the war and then married him. And in a way, he was kind of a support to her as well. And she was kind of devoted to him. So in a way, he kind of looked after her in a way. So it was quite a good relationship in that sense. Other people who saw them together thought it was a very kind of bad relationship. They thought Kenneth Darrell Waters was a kind of ignorant man who was only interested in money, and was a kind of the worst companion for a creative person in that sense as well. But the marriage seemed to have worked. They stayed together till their deaths in the 1960s, and he was very protective of her as well, which is kind of what she wanted in a sense. She was quite old-fashioned, I think. She wanted a man to protect her.
In 1968, she died at the age of 71, and she suffered with dementia, didn't she, Andrew Maunder?
Yes.
Which is a terrible fate for a writer.
Yes, I think it is. So she had this massive, massive output and was churning out these stories. But round about the kind of early 1960s, she started to have trouble remembering things. She started to slow down. She'd had trouble kind of composing stories. So her last stories were published in 1963. But yes, she kind of tended to kind of live in the past a bit more and had trouble remembering more recent events. So yeah, her career gradually kind of, her writing in a sense gradually dwindled away. Mm-hmm. Although her books were still popular because they were still being reprinted all this time as well.
I think I read when asked at the very end of her life if she wanted to see her children, who had been quite estranged from her, she turned to her library that were filled with all of her own books and she said, "These are my children," in reference to her books.
Yes, that is a very kind of famous quote in a sense that, yes, the kind of the her books were the kind of product of her life's work in a way. And she, again, deservedly, I think she was proud of her achievements in that sense.
Extraordinary when you think. She has sold more than 600 million books worldwide. That is an incredible number for one person to have sold.
Yes, it's a kind of figure that's quite hard to conceive. And I think it's probably because she's a good storyteller when it comes down to it. She writes in very clear prose. She writes kind of about children put in situations where they're allowed to be, as I say, independent and brave and adventurous. And in things like the boarding school stories, she offers a kind of a vision of school life that most of her readers will never, ever see. They'll never, ever go to boarding school, for example, but presents it as a world, again, where you can have fun, where adults are kind of on the periphery, on the outside. And it's about children kind of being in control in a way a lot of the time, I think.
Well, I mentioned The Famous Five, such a huge part of my childhood, reading, I think, those books every night for many, many years. I think there were many books in that series, 20 or more at least. But for you, Andrew Maunder, what do you think is the standout Enid Blyton book series?
I think it is The Famous Five, actually, but the early ones. So what I think happens with Blyton is that when she starts a series, her early novels, so like Five on the Treasure Island or Five Go to Smuggler's Top, as it were, they're the better ones. But then when she starts writing a series, they become more formulaic, if you like. So it's in a way, it's almost a shame that she didn't write less and spend longer on the books that she did write, if that makes sense in a way. But she kind of fell, as I say, into this treadmill of having to supply her publishers with a new Famous Five title every year and a new Secret Seven title and so on. So the kind of early novels of a series, like, yeah, The Five on the Treasure Island or The Mystery of the Burnt Cottage or Mallory Towers and so on. These kind of early books of a series are where she's somehow demonstrating her creativity at its best, if you like, I think.
Enid Blyton, the children's favourite storyteller, certainly a woman, a one-woman marketing machine, Andrew. Thank you so much for bringing us a few of the insights into Enid Blyton. Do you think she will stand up into the future? Do you think she will be continued to be printed and sold and read throughout the world into the future?
Well, there's no sign of her disappearing at the moment, I guess. And as I say, her publishers are still marketing her books and she's still selling. And I think it is the fact that she does write, for the most part, good stories that children respond to. And also I think that children can read on their own as well. That's part of it, that they don't need adults to read it along with them anyway.
Andrew Maunder, thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Maunder is a lecturer in English literature in the UK. He is also the author of Enid Blyton, A Literary Life. You're on Weekend Night Live with me, Renee Crosh.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.